I'd like to say welcome to everyone today. It's a rainy day in Virginia. It's good to be here. We are here in Virginia today along with Laura and Myrtle and myself and a lot of other people that are scattered throughout wherever. Brethren, we've been going through a series of sermons about the creating God. And we've addressed in those sermons about angels that rebelled against God. And we've looked at what Satan did. And we saw how he did not like God's plan for mankind. And we know that he rebelled against the great God of this universe. So today we will look at some accounts of those that chose to go against God and how God was doing things. And just as those angelic beings chose to go against how God was doing things along with Satan, we will look at some that rebelled against those that God was using, and we will see how God judged those that rebelled at that time. So the title today will be Rebellion. You can be turning to the book of Jude. We've been referencing Jude in the past sermons. And Jude tells us about some accounts of rebellion that took place. And Jude tells us and reminds us not to forget these examples that he talks about. And in the last sermon, we mentioned examples that was given in the book of Jude about those that rebel. And Jude wrote and tells us that our past history warns us that the unfaithful have mingled with the faithful. And we will see this today in this sermon. I will read some of this today in the Phillips translation, as it's better said in some verses. Let's look at Jude and let's start in verse 5 and look at what was said. Jude says, I want to remind you of something that you really know already. And although the Eternal saved all the people from the land of Egypt, yet afterwards he brought to their downfall those that would not trust him. And the angels who did not keep their proper domain, but left their own abode. And let's notice what God says he has done. He has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness, let's notice, for the judgment of the great day. And in the last sermon, we looked at how God just asked Job some questions. And when God was questioning Job, God asked Job if he could reserve a day for judgment in the future. And we know that God asked Job, where was he when he, God, set aside this day of judgment that would be in our future? And we saw Job's responses, how Job came to understand some things about his God. And Job came to understand that he knew absolutely nothing in the scheme of things without what God let him know. Let's notice what's being said about two cities, Sodom and Gomorrah. Sodom and Gomorrah and the ancient adjacent cities, who in the same way as these men today, gave themselves up to sexual immorality and perversion. Standing their punishment is a permanent warning of the fire of judgment. Hold your place here in Jude, and let's go to the book of Genesis, and let's quickly look at this account of what took place. And let's look at Genesis 19 and verse 1. Genesis 19 and verse 1. And this is the account of when Lot leaves Sodom and what takes place. In Genesis 19 and verse 1, we find, and it says, two angels came to Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting near the city gate. And when Lot saw them, he got up and went to them and bowed face down on the ground. So we can see that Lot was able to recognize them for who they were. Lot says, please come to my house and spend the night. And there you can wash your feet, and then tomorrow you may continue on your journey. And the angels answered and said, "No, we will spend the night in the city's public square." But Lot begged them to come, so they agreed and went to his house. Then Lot prepared a meal for them. And let's notice what he baked with. He baked bread without yeast, and they ate it. And before bedtime, both men, both young and old, from every part of Sodom surrounded Lot's house. And they called to Lot, "Where are the two men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us so that we can know them." And we know what this means. We understand what was being said. And we can see in our nation some cities that have become just as immoral as this. And we can see how immoral the whole city had become in Lot's time. And it reminds us of cities like San Francisco and how permissive that city has become. And the perversion that is allowed. And most of today's society think nothing of it. Let's drop down to verse 14. The angels told Lot that he and his family had to leave, that the cities were going to be destroyed. And in verse 14, we find that Lot went out and said to his future son-in-laws, who were pledged to marry his daughters, and he told them to hurry and leave this city. The Eternal is about to destroy it. And we can see their reaction, and we can see that they did not take Lot serious, just like they don't take you serious. And this would cost them their lives because of this. And we are not taken serious, and I think most of you have experienced this and are still experiencing it. God's final witness is going out to this world, and none take it seriously to this day, except a few that God has called and that God is working with. We know this age of man is coming to an end, and there will be much destruction as Satan's world comes to a close. Verse 15. At dawn the next morning, the angels begged Lot to hurry. And they said, "Go and take your wife and your two daughters, so that you will not be destroyed when the city is punished, when the city is destroyed." But Lot delayed. And we are so entangled in our world. And it was no different in Lot's time. Lot was very entangled in that world that was around him. And Lot was leaving everything behind. So here it says that Lot was delayed. And he was probably reflecting back on everything that he was leaving behind, which would be a normal thing to do. That's what most would do. But the two men, so we can see the angels were in the appearance as men. That's how they appeared and that's how they looked. Just like you and me. And they took the hand of Lot and his wife and his two daughters and led them safely out of the city. So the Eternal was merciful to Lot and his family. And after they had brought them out of the city, one of the men said, "Run for your lives." Let's notice the instructions that were being given, because it was very important to obey what they said. Don't look back or stop anywhere in the valley. Run to the mountains or you will be destroyed. Lot said to one of them, "Sir, please don't force me to go so far. You have been merciful and kind to me and have saved my life. But I can't run to the mountains. The disaster will catch me and I will die. Look, that little town over there is not too far away. Let me run there. It's really just a little town and I'll be safe there." And the angel said to Lot, "Very well, I will allow you to do this, and I will not destroy that town. But run there fast, because I cannot destroy Sodom until you are safely in that town." And that town is named Zoar because it is little. That's what the name means. So Sodom and Gomorrah are destroyed because of sin. It had become so corrupt that God passed judgment and destroyed them. The sun had already come up when Lot entered Zoar. And the Eternal sent a rain of burning sulfur down from the sky on Sodom and Gomorrah and destroyed those cities. He also destroyed the whole Jordan Valley, everyone living in those cities, and even all the plants. Verse 26. Let's see what happened because of someone that disobeyed. At that point, Lot's wife looked back, and she disobeyed what she had been told. And she looked back. And when she did, she became a pillar of salt. Judgment was swift for her. And her judgment was not delayed as some are being delayed today. Hopefully her final judgment has not been made and is awaiting a resurrection in the future. Just because judgment is delayed does not mean that they have not been judged. Judgment can be for a time in the future, for the lake of fire, never to have life again. Verse 27. Early the next morning, Abraham got up and went to the place where he had stood before the Eternal. And he looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah and all the Jordan Valley and saw smoke rising from the land and like smoke from a furnace. God destroyed the cities in the valley, but he remembered what Abraham had asked. So God saved Lot's life, but he destroyed the city where Lot had lived. Let's go back to the book of Jude. Hopefully everyone kept their place. But let's go back to Jude and pick up in verse 7. Sodom and Gomorrah and the adjacent cities, who in the same way as these men today, gave themselves up to sexual immorality and perversion, standing their punishment as a permanent warning of the fire of judgment. Yet these men are defiling their bodies by their filthy fantasies in just the same way. They show utter contempt for authority and make a jest of the heavenly glories. But I would remind you that even the archangel Michael, when he was contending with the devil, Satan, in the dispute over the body of Moses, did not dare to condemn him with mockery. And he just said, "The Eternal rebuke you." Verse 10. These fellows, however, are ready to mock at anything. And there are those that speak evil of the ones that God is using today. And they hate those that God is using. And they are not afraid to say so, brethren. God says that it is beyond their immediate knowledge, while in the things they know by instinct. In other words, they are using the natural carnal mind. And while in the things they know by instinct, like unreasoning beast, you can tell them nothing, brethren. They think they understand it all. And it's not someone you can talk to. And they have become utterly depraved in their mind. They do corrupt themselves, and they are using the natural carnal mind to do so when it takes place. And it is naturally hostile to God, as we know. And it's hostile to God's way of life. And it says, "Woe to them." That's what God says. Woe to them. In other words, it's not over yet, brethren. God has a day in the future that will deal with those that have rebelled and have refused to repent. And they are just like Lot's future son-in-laws today and do not take what God says seriously. For they have taken the road of Cain. For what they could get, they have rushed into the same era as Balaam. And you know, God had a donkey talk to Balaam. So, you know, a donkey's pretty dumb. So I'm pretty sure it got Balaam's attention. But it says, they have destroyed themselves. Let's notice how they destroyed themselves. By rebelling against God, as Korah did a long time ago. Another translation says it this way, it will be terrible for them. They have followed the way of Cain, and for money they have given themselves to doing the wrong that Balaam did. And they have fought against God as Korah did, and like Korah, they surely will be destroyed. So this is better said through these two translations. Today we will look at what God says about those that rebel and do such things. They think they are free to rebel against those that God is using. We will see how God has handled those in the past that took to themselves and went against those servants of God, those that God had chosen. Therefore, the title today is Rebellion. That's why it's called Rebellion. And let's see what the example of Korah was all about. Some may know and some may not know, because I don't know if we focused a lot upon this in the past. God says that these are examples for those that dare do such a thing. Those that rebel against what God is doing and those that God is using. And we will look at some examples today in God's book. Let's turn over to Numbers 4. And let's get a look at what the duties of the sons of Kohath was, so that we can have an understanding of what their job was. And in Numbers chapter 4, and we will start in verse 1, let's see what the duties were of the sons of Kohath. Korah was the grandson of Kohath, and you may want to note that. Then the Eternal spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, take a census of the sons of Kohath from among the children of Levi, by their families, by their father's house, from 30 years old and above, even to 50 years old. All who entered the service to do the work, let's notice, in the tabernacle of meeting. So we can see that their job entailed work that was performed in the tabernacle of meeting. Verse 4, this is the service of the sons of Kohath in the tabernacle of meeting, relating to the most holy things. When the camp prepares the journeys, so this is what was to take place and the order of the way things were to be done. Aaron and his sons shall come, and they shall take down the covering veil and cover the ark of the testimony with it. Then they shall put on it a covering of badger skins, and spread over that a cloth entirely of blue. And they shall insert its poles. And this was because they carried it by these poles. That's why they were doing this. On the table of showbread they shall spread a blue cloth, and put on it the dishes, the pans, the bowls, the pitchers for pouring, and the showbread shall be upon it. They shall spread over them a scarlet cloth, and cover the same with a covering of badger skins. And they shall insert its poles. And it's like I said earlier, that's because they were to carry it. That's the way they were to transport these things. And they shall take a blue cloth and cover the lampstand of the light with its lamps, its wick trimmers, its trays, and all its oil vessels with which they service it. Then they shall put it and all its utensils in a covering of badger skins and put it on a carrying beam. Over the golden altar they shall spread a blue cloth and cover it with a covering of badger skins, and they shall insert its poles. Then they shall take all the utensils of service with which they minister in the sanctuary and put them in a blue cloth, cover them with a covering of badger skins, and put them on a carrying beam. Also they shall take away the ashes from the altar and spread a purple cloth over it. And they shall put on it all its implements with which they minister there, the fire pans, its censers, said in some translations, the forks, the shovels, the basins, and the utensils of the altar. And they shall spread upon it a covering of badger skins and insert its poles. And when Aaron and his sons have finished covering the sanctuary and all the furnishings of the sanctuary, when the camp is set to go, let's notice, then the sons of Kohath shall come to carry them. But they shall not touch any holy thing, lest they die. God was very specific in what they were not to do. it would be rebellion not to do as God instructed. These are the things in the tabernacle of meeting which the sons of Kohath are to carry. So we can see what their job was and how it was to be carried out. God was very specific of what to do and what not to do. Verse 17. We can see God telling Moses about the Kohathites and the instructions that were given. God setting them aside so that they would not die while doing their work. Then the Eternal spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "Do not let the clan of Kohath be killed by coming near these most sacred objects." And the New King James says it, "Do not cut off the tribe." God said to prevent them from happening, in other words, to prevent them from dying, "Aaron and his son shall go in and assign each man his task and tell him what to carry of the families of the Kohathites from among the Levites. But they shall not go in to watch while the holy things are being covered, lest they die." Very specific. And God is very precise in how they were to carry out His orders and what they were to do and what they were not to do. Let's go to number 16 and let's look at verse 1. We will see the rebellion that took place. And this rebellion took place really against the great God of this universe when we understand. And this is the rebellion that Jude told us about in his book. "Now Korah, the son of Ishar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and on the sons of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took men." So we can see the beginning of the rebellion taking place. And the story of the rebellion of Korah is recorded here in Numbers 16. And this rebellion of Korah demonstrates the consequences of those that go against God and those that He has chosen to be leaders of His people. And Korah was the oldest son of Ishar, who was the son of Kohath of the tribe of Levi. Korah then was of the same tribe as Moses and Aaron. And he led a rebellion against Moses and Aaron, accusing them of exalting themselves above the congregation of the Eternal. Verse 2. Korah was not alone in his charge. Let's notice what he did. "And they rose up before Moses and with some of the children of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, representatives of the congregation, men of renown." So this is the leaders. And everyone knows who they are. "And they gathered together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, 'You take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Eternal is among them. Why then do you exalt yourself above the assembly of the Eternal?'" So we see Korah accusing Moses and Aaron. And the truth was that Moses was not aspired to his position. We know the story of Moses. We know that God indeed called Moses. And we know the story of how Moses was called. We remember the burning bush and how Moses was called. And we know Moses did not, in fact, see himself as above the congregation because of what God had written in his book. We know that Moses was a meek and humble man and was faithful to his God. We can see that Korah undoubtedly thought that he could do a better job leading the people than Moses was doing. By leading this rebellion against God's divinely appointed leaders, Korah and his followers were actually rebelling against the great God of this universe. Verse 4. Let's see what Moses did when he heard this from Korah. "When Moses heard it, he fell upon his face." Moses understood how serious this was. Moses knew that God would not take rebellion lightly. and that there would be grave consequences for rebelling against God and what he was doing. And this desperate action showed that Moses took the threat of judgment seriously. Moses understood that this was no small thing. And it is the same with us in the ministry. When we see one going against God and actually rebelling, we are a family, brother. And it hurts when we see one that was a friend, one that we walked side by side to on God's house, and sometimes for many, many years together. And it tears your heart out sometimes because you understand, just as Moses did, how serious an offense it is to rebel against our God. Verse 4, when Moses heard it, he fell on his face because he knew the consequences of such an act, as we will see in verse 5. Moses spoke to Korah and all his company, saying, "Tomorrow morning the Eternal will show who is his and who is holy, and will cause him to come near to him. That one whom he chooses, he will cause to come near to him. Do this, take censers, your fire pans, Korah and all your company, and put fire in them, and put incense them before the Eternal tomorrow. And it will be that the man whom the Lord chooses is the Holy One." And let's notice what was said. "You take too much upon yourselves, you sons of Levi." And we've seen it over and over, even in the Church of God in our time, when they take it to themselves to know what is good and what is right. But we know what it actually is. It's rebellion. Moses said to Korah, "Hear now, you sons of Levi." Let's notice what Moses said to them. "Is it a small thing to you that the God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do the work of the tabernacle of the Eternal, and to stand before the congregation?" So we can see what their position was and what their job was. God had placed them in a position to serve. And Moses is asking them, "Are you not appreciative of the job that God has given you to be able to come?" Let's notice what's being said. To be able to come close to the great God of this universe in service to him. That's what it actually was. We've had friends in the ministry, evangelists, elders, and brethren that have left God's church that were in a position to serve just as these were, brethren. And they took understanding to themselves that they can serve God outside the body of Christ. And they have no fear of God by doing so. And they do not think that they have left God, brethren. They think they are still serving their God. Moses asked them, "Is it a small thing to you?" And we can ask that same question to those that have rebelled against God at our time. Is it a small thing? What was it worth to know what you know, brother? That the great God of this universe has opened up your mind to see his plan for all of mankind. Verse 10, that he has brought you near to himself, and he's done the same for you and me to understand. And Moses said, "You and all your brethren, the sons of Levi, with you." It's the question that Moses was asking them. And let's notice the next question that Moses asked them. "Are you seeking the priesthood also? Therefore, you and all your company are gathered together." Let's notice what Moses told them and who it was against. Moses said, "Therefore, you and all your company are gathered together against the eternal God of this universe. And what is Aaron that you complain against him?" In other words, what had Aaron done? Why are they complaining against Aaron? What does Aaron have to do with any of this? Moses sent to Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab. And let's notice what they did, what they said. They said, "We will not come up. We're not coming." So we can see that they were rebelling also. And let's notice what's said in verse 13. Is it a small thing that you have brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey? So let's pay attention to what they were saying and how they were saying it. You have brought us out of a land flowing with milk and honey. Now we know that Egypt was anything but a land flowing with milk and honey. And they lied. That's what they did. They were slaves, brethren, in Egypt. And they had hard taskmasters. Remember the bricks without straw? And here, they are accusing Moses of bringing them out of Egypt. But we know that it was God that brought them out of Egypt. It was God that delivered them. And this shows that Dathan and Abiram colored the past. They lied. They told Moses that Egypt was a land of milk and honey for the Hebrew slaves. Divisive people commonly create a past of their own preference. And they paint a past that puts leaders like Moses in the worst possible light. And you know what? They do the same thing today, brother, to those of us in PKG. They color what we are doing. And they lie. And let's notice the rest as it gets worse. They accuse Moses of bringing them out of slavery to kill them in the wilderness. So this shows that Dathan and Abiram assigned an evil heart to Moses, just as they did to us in the trial of Ron Wineland. They accused Ron of having a black heart, an evil heart. And they spoke as if they had discovered the plot of Moses and Aaron to lead the nation into the wilderness and then kill them. And the foolishness of all of this shows how, against all reasons, those that rebel and become divisive people often assign every intention of the heart to leaders like Moses and Ron Wineland and us also, brethren. They say what we are doing is evil. They accuse Moses of bringing them out to kill them in the wilderness. And let's notice that you should keep acting like a prince over us. Verse 14. Moreover, you have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor given us inheritance of fields and vineyards. Sound familiar? Nothing you said has come true, Moses. And they are rebelling. And they said, we will not come up. Then Moses was very upset about this lying that was taking place. And Moses said to the Eternal, do not respect their offering. I have not taken one donkey from them. And Moses said to God, nor have I hurt one of them. Moses said to Korah, tomorrow you and all your company be present before the Eternal. You and they as well as Aaron, and let each one take his fire pan, his censer, and put incense in it. And each of you bring his censer before the Eternal, 250 censers, both you and Aaron, each with his censer. So every man took his censer, put fire in it, laid incense upon it, and stood at the door of the tabernacle of meeting with Moses and Aaron. And Korah gathered all the congregation against them at the door. Let's notice where it all took place and where it's taking place. At the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Then the glory of the Eternal appeared to all the congregation. And I can only imagine being able to experience such a thing as this. What they were able to see and what they were able to witness. To see such a sight as this. And the Eternal spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, separate yourself from among this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment. We will understand why God said this as we go through the story and see how so many rebelled. After all that they had seen God do, after all the sights of being delivered through that Red Sea, then they fell upon their faces and said, O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin and you be angry with all the congregation? So the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the congregation, saying, get away from the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Moses rose and went to Dathan and Abiram, and the elders of Israel followed him. So we can see all this gathering and all this taking place. And he spoke to the congregation, saying, depart now from the tents of these wicked men. And let's notice the instruction. Touch nothing of theirs, lest you be consumed in all their sins. Instructions that are for you and me today, and how we are to associate with those who have left God's church and choose to rebel. We are not to touch anything of theirs, brethren. Especially with our ears, with our hearing of what they are saying about the ones that are leading God's church at this time. So they got away from the tents of Korah, Dathan and Abiram, and Dathan and Abiram came out and stood at the door of their tents with their wives, their sons, and their little children. Moses said, by this you shall know that the Eternal has sent me to do all his works. So notice what Moses told them. For I have not done them of my own will. God did the works, brethren, not Moses. If these men died naturally, like all men, or if they are visited by the common fate of all men, then the Eternal has not sent me. But if the Eternal creates a new thing, and the earth opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that belong to them, and they go down alive into the pit, then you will understand that these men have rejected the Eternal. Now it came to pass as he finished speaking all these words that the ground split apart upon them, under them, and the earth opens its mouth and swallowed them up with their households and all the men with Korah, with all their goods. So they and all those with them went down alive into the pit. Can you imagine witnessing such a thing as this? There is a day of judgment in the future, brethren. But this says, they went down alive into the pit, and the earth closed over them. And they perished from among the assembly. Can you imagine seeing such a thing? And then all Israel who were around them fled at their cry. And they said, lest the earth swallow us up also. And a fire came out from the Eternal, and let's notice, and consumed the 250 men who were offering incense. Then the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, tell Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, to pick up the censers out of the blaze, for they are holy, and scatter the fire some distance away. So can you imagine the scene that was taking place? The priests are picking up among the bodies the charred flesh that was there and the stench of all that was there at that time. And they are to make a count, and they are to hunt 250 censers among that burning flesh, and not one is to be lost. The censers of these men who sinned against their own souls, let them be made into hammered plates as a covering for the altar. Because they presented them before the Eternal, therefore they are holy. And they shall be a sign to the children of Israel. So Eleazar the priest took the bronze censers with which those who were burned up had presented. And they were hammered out as a covering on the altar. Let's notice verse 40. To be a memorial to the children of Israel, that no outsider who is not a descendant of Aaron should come near to offer incense before the Eternal, that he might not become like Korah and his companions, just as the Eternal has said to him through Moses. A lesson for us today, brethren. As God had it written in the book of Jude, for a reminder to you and me about those that have rebelled and what the punishment is for rebellion. After all that they had seen, wouldn't you think by the power that they had seen God use, it would have their attention Wouldn't you think in the church of God today, with all that God has done for you and me, God gave it as an example for you and me at the end of this age. And let's notice what they did. The following day, instead of being convinced that God had vindicated Moses and Aaron, the congregation began complaining that they, Moses and Aaron, let's notice, had killed the Eternal's people. It was their fault. And for this act of rebellion, God threatened to destroy the whole congregation. And he sent a plague among them. And let's notice what Moses and Aaron did. After all this rebellion against them, Moses and Aaron still interceded for these people that were daring to rebel. After all that they had seen, but Moses interceded and averted a complete catastrophe. And let's look at what took place. Verse 41. On the next day, all the congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, saying, "You have killed the people of the Eternal." And when the congregation had assembled against Moses and Aaron, they turned toward the tent of meeting. And their intent must have not have been good, brethren. It says they turned toward the tent of meeting. So what was in their mind? This is where they were headed. And let's see what God did when they did this act. And behold, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Eternal appeared. So let's pay attention to what's taking place and what Moses and Aaron did and where they went to. Verse 43. Moses and Aaron came, and let's notice, to the front of the tent of meeting. And the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, "Get away from the midst of this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment." And let's notice what Moses and Aaron did, because they knew how serious an offense this was. And they fell upon their faces. And Moses said to Aaron, "Take your censer and put fire on it from the altar and lay incense upon it and carry it quickly to the congregation and make atonement for them. For wrath has come out from the Eternal. The plague has begun." So Aaron took the fire pan, the censer, as Moses said, and ran into the midst of the congregation, the assembly. And behold, the plague had already begun among the people. And he put on the incense and made atonement for the people. And let's notice, and he, Aaron, stood between the dead and the living, and the plague was stopped. Now those who died in the plague, let's notice how many, 14,700, besides those who died in the affair of Korah. And Aaron returned to Moses at the entrance of the tent of meeting when the plague was stopped. Many years later, Jude records a strong warning about men. Men and women who come into the church. It's not just men, it's men and women. Arrogating to themselves their authority of God in His Word. God says, "Woe to them, for they walk in the way of Cain, and abandon themselves for the sake of gain to Balaam's error, and they will perish just like those in Korah's rebellion." And Jude tells you and me to always remember these accounts of what took place. And it is an example for you and me of how serious rebellion is. Let's go to the book of Titus. Titus in chapter 3. And Titus is right behind 2 Timothy, if that will help you, and it's two chapters ahead of Hebrews. And I'm going to read this in a modern translation. Titus chapter 3 and verse 1. And it says, "Remind them." So this applies to you and me at the end of an age. "Remind your people to submit to rulers and authorities, to obey them, and to be ready to do good in every way. Tell them not to speak evil of anyone, but to be peaceful and friendly, and always show a gentle attitude toward everyone. For we ourselves were once foolish, disobedient, and wrong. We were slaves to passions and pleasures of all kinds, we spent our lives in malice and envy. Others hated us, and we hated them. And that's a pretty good description of where we came from in Satan's world. And when the kindness and love of God our Savior was revealed, He saved us because we were called out, and we are in that process. And it's not because of any good deeds that we ourselves are doing or had done, but because of His own mercy that He is saving us through the Holy Spirit, which gives us new birth and new life by washing us. And it gives you a new mind, brother. God poured out the Holy Spirit abundantly on us. And by His grace, we might be put right with God and come into possession of the eternal life that we hope for. And this is a true saying. I want you to give special emphasis to these matters so that those who believe in God may be concerned with giving their time to doing good deeds, which are good and useful for everyone. But avoid stupid arguments, long list of genealogy and quarrels and fightings about the law. They are useless and worthless. Give at least two warnings to those who cause divisions. Here's some instructions. Give two warnings to those who cause divisions, and then have nothing more to do with them. You know that such people are corrupt, and their sins prove that they are wrong. So we can see our instructions of what is to take place. You can be turning to Romans 16. All of us have been confronted by divisive people at some time in our lives. And we've seen through God's book today how those become corrupt and divisive usually end up when one chooses to rebel. The end results will not be good. God tells us how we are to handle those that cause divisions. So let's see what God tells us through His Word. Romans 16, and let's start in verse 17. Avoid divisive persons. That's the heading in my Bible. So that's the context of what is being discussed. Now I urge you, brethren, note those, in other words, mark those, who cause divisions and offenses, contrary to the doctrine which you learned, and avoid them. And it's just as what was said about Korah. They were told not to touch anything of Korah's and those that rebelled. And we are to do the same today in the Church of God, PKG. We're not to touch anything, especially through the ears, by touching what they are saying and what they are saying. For those who are such do not serve our Lord Jesus Christ, but their own belly. And by smooth words and flattering speech, deceive the heart, the minds of the simple. For your obedience has become known to all. Therefore, I am glad on your behalf, but I want you to be wise in what is good and simple concerning evil. And the God of peace will crush Satan under your feet shortly. And we look so forward to when this being will be put in prison. And it's just a short while now, brethren. And I'm glad it's not very long. God has continuously warned you and me about pride, about selfishness, about jealousy, and about greed, and lust for power and disregard for the will of God. And just like Korah, there are those that disregard God's plan and are hostile to God's appointed authorities. Their end will be the same as Korah's. Therefore, this warning, woe to them. We just saw that God had selected men of His own choosing. And God has no interest in letting someone appoint themselves, brother. Korah's problem was that he was attempting to install himself as the leader, and claims that Moses set himself above the eternal assembly. God did not call Korah. God called Moses. And God calls whom He chooses to lead His church. Let's turn over to 1 Samuel 15. 1 Samuel 15 and verse 16. Most of us are familiar with this account of King Saul. And it's just a few short verses. But let's take a look at it. 1 Samuel chapter 15 and verse 16. And the scene is where the prophet Samuel is talking with Saul, who was the king. He was in charge, brethren, the king, the one with all the authority, the ruler. And no one was to answer. He had no one to answer to except the great God of this universe. And let's see what he did. Samuel said to Saul, this is what he said to the king now. Be quiet. In other words, shut up and listen. So, put yourself in his shoes to tell the king this. This was the king that he was talking to. And Samuel told him to shut up and listen. And I will tell you what the Eternal said to me last night. And he said to him, speak on. In other words, tell me. So Samuel said, let's see what Samuel was telling Saul. Because Samuel was addressing something that Saul the king had become. And let's see what Samuel told the king, the one who was in all authority. These are the questions that Samuel asked Saul. When you were little in your own eyes, were you not head of the tribes of Israel? And did not the Eternal anoint you king over Israel? Now the Eternal sent you on a mission and said, go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed. And we're not going to go into this whole story, but let's notice what was said, because it's about rebellion that took place. Saul did not obey what God told him to do. In verse 15, why then did you not obey the voice of the Eternal? That's the question that was asked. Why did you swoop down on the spoil, and let's notice, and do evil in the sight of the Eternal? Samuel said that it was an evil thing that Saul had done. Saul said to Samuel, here comes the justification that comes with sin, with rebellion. But I have obeyed the voice of the Eternal. And all those that have rebelled against God in our time, they think they are obeying the great God of this universe and His Son. They don't think they're disobeying. But I have obeyed the voice of the Eternal and gone on the mission which the Eternal sent me. And that's exactly what they think today. They think they are still in the church of God, brother. But they are outside the body of Christ. And brought back Agag, king of Amalek. I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. And let's notice what he said. The people took of the plunder, sheep and oxen, the best of the things which should have been utterly destroyed to sacrifice to the Eternal, your God, in Gilgad. So here he places the blame upon the people. And here we see the justification of why it was done. Samuel said, has the Eternal as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Eternal? Behold, let's notice, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. Verse 23. Let's see what God had written about what Saul had done about rebellion. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Eternal, He has also rejected you from being king. God placed judgment upon Saul. And another translation says it this way, disobedience is as bad as the sin of sorcery. Pride is as bad as the sin of worshiping idols. You have rejected the Eternal's command. Now He rejects you as king. Judgment. The example of Korah and those who wanted more. They wanted authority. They wanted power. And just like those in the spirit realm that rebelled and wanted more. God tells us about his great creation of Lucifer and of the magnificence that he gave to Lucifer. God has also shown how Lucifer became lifted up with pride and that he desired more than what God gave to him. He was not content with the abundance that God had given him, just like Korah and those that rebelled. Lucifer rebelled against God and became the great adversary to God's purpose for life. And in his treacherous rebellion, he seduced a third of the angelic realm to follow him. Lucifer became Satan the devil, as we know. Satan has hated the plan of God for his family Elohim ever since he learned of it from God. Jealousy entered into him, along with bitterness and hate. And he has been on a destructive path of violence and destruction ever since. Satan tried to destroy this earth itself, but God prevented it. And we went through this in a previous sermon. And we saw how God refashioned this earth and created man upon it. Satan has hated the plan of God concerning the purpose of mankind. And he has worked to destroy what God is creating and God's purpose for mankind. Satan rebelled against what God is creating, the creation of his family, Elohim. Satan has tried to destroy God's plan and purpose for mankind down through time. But it is because of all that Satan has done that God is able to turn it around and use it to create his family, Elohim. The existence of such evil upon this earth was necessary for the creation of God's family, when we understand. And Satan has actually aided in the development of the character for those that will be in the family of God. And that which Satan has so hated, brethren, God has turned it around and used it. And that has to infuriate him to no end. God says he's like a roaring lion out to devour everything he can devour, especially you. As this age comes to a close, the Day of Atonement is a day that pictures a lot about this being that rebelled, Satan. And we saw what God revealed to his church through Ronald Wineland, that God has passed judgment upon Satan. We know the first judgment that everyone in God's church is familiar with, and that's of Satan being removed from the presence of man, of mankind, during the millennial reign of Jesus Christ upon this earth. That's the first judgment. God has reserved the pronouncement of Satan's judgment, and he told us about it through Ronald Wineland. God had it written concerning Satan's judgment in his book, God's book. And I will be quoting from some of the writings from Ronald Wineland in some of the rest of this sermon, so you will know where I got the information. At the return of Jesus Christ as King of Kings, Satan is imprisoned for 1,000 years and then released for a short while, and we will see his end. And let's look at this account in Revelation 20 and verse 1. Very familiar scriptures. And it tells us a lot about Satan. Revelation 20 and verse 1. I saw an angel come down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit, the abyss. In other words, a place of restraint, endless restraint, until unlocked. And a great chain in his hand, and he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years and cast him into the bottomless pit, the abyss, shut him up and set a seal upon him, that he should not deceive the nations anymore until the 1,000 years would be fulfilled. And after that, he must be released for a little season. And Satan at the end is to be released for a very short while. At that time, he will seek to destroy what God is creating, and he will again fail miserably, brethren. But he will try it once again. God's judgment on Satan and his punishment for his rebellion has now been revealed to you and me. God's church at the end of this age. The remnant, those at the end. Just before Satan will be put into his prison for his rebellion. And let's see his fate that was revealed. Verse 7. When the 1,000 years has expired, Satan will be released out of his prison and will go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them to battle. Let's notice. The number of whom is as the sand of the sea. So we can see by what is written that it is a lot, brethren. And it will be massive. And it says, whose numbers? That is as the sand of the sea. When Satan is released from his confinement, he will be released to do his evil work upon this world for one more time, to cause many to rebel with him once again. We understand that Satan is set in his way. The mind of man is not set, but can change. Man does not have a spirit mind fully composed of spirit. The angels were composed of spirit and given minds fully of spirit, but not the Holy Spirit. And at any time that one would choose a way other than God's way, then that mind would become set in its own way. So when Satan is released, he will be the same, brother. And he will set out to destroy once again. Together those that will rebel with him. And it's hard to comprehend such a thing. But God had it written in his book. But this time God stops it. And this great event will then become one of the last great lessons from which the children of God will learn. During this time, those have been deceived into following Satan, and there will be many, as we just read, that rebel. And they will try to destroy what God has built. Revelation 20 and verse 9. And they went up upon the breadth of the earth and encompassed, let's notice, the camp of the saints in the beloved city. And fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. God stops it. And the devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone where the beast and the false prophet are. And the correct way that this should read is, where the beast and false prophet were earlier cast and shall be tormented day and night forever and ever. And the expression of a lake of fire burning with brimstone is a biblical expression defined as a totally consuming fire with heat so intense that it cannot be extinguished until it has fully consumed what is in it. The expression is used in the complete consuming of Sodom and Gomorrah that we just read about. And in the book of Jude, where Sodom and Gomorrah is used as an example, that's why it's there. And God told us through Jude that it is something that we are to always remember. We are always to remember what rebellion causes and the end result of rebellion, and how God will deal with rebellion at a day that he has reserved, that he told Job about a long, long time ago. That he, God, had the power to reserve a day for those that rebel, a day of final judgment. The lake of fire and hellfire, Gehenna fire, are all expressions of actual punishment that will consume, that will destroy those who are unrepentant as a matter of final judgment, meaning they will never be given life again. And this is a final sentence of eternal punishment. That's what it means. It is a punishment that lasts for eternity because they can never be resurrected to have life again. And this is not meaning being eternally punished. When it says that the devil will be cast into this lake of fire, it goes on to say that he shall be tormented day and night forever. And you may want to note some of this. And it's easy to read the wrong meaning into this, as we know some of this is awkwardly translated. It does not say that he will be tormented in the fire forever. However, it does say that he will be tormented forever, which simply means that he will be tormented without end, if you want to note it. That's what it means. In other words, he will be tormented ceaselessly until the time punishment is completed. That is what is being said. From the moment that Satan heard that the judgment upon him is to cease to exist, and he heard that through Ronald Wyman, brother, that because of his rebellion, his judgment upon him is to cease to exist. And he is mentally tormented by that knowledge on a continuing basis, ceaselessly, without end, until the end. The pronouncement upon Satan is absolute and is sure. His end is near. He has very little time to be in the presence of mankind to deceive and torment mankind. He is now entering a time of torment upon himself, which is the result of his own doing through his rebellion. Let's turn over to Ezekiel 28, and let's see how Satan comes to his end. Ezekiel 28. God revealed a lot about Satan in the book of Ezekiel, and God gave prophecy about Satan's end. And God gave through Ronald Wyman his end, what it would be. So let's read about Satan and his end that is written in God's book. Ezekiel 28, and we'll start in verse 11. Moreover, the word of the Eternal came unto me, saying, Son of man, take up a lamentation upon the king of Tyrus. And this is a rule equated with Satan, and say to him, Thus says the Eternal God, you sealed up the sum full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You have been in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering, the sardis, the topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, the jasper, the sapphire, the emerald, and the carbuncle, and gold, the workmanship of your tablets. And we know that this is used to symbolize the production of music. And of your pipes, your settings is done by a jeweler, a fine jeweler, a craftsman, and was prepared in you in the day you were created. So we see God created this being. All the angelic realm was created, brethren. Everything has been created by the great God of this universe, and he sustains all of it. And he says, you were an anointed cherub who covers, and I had set you, you were upon the holy mountain of God. In other words, in the highest government of God. That's where he was. You have walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire. You were perfect in your ways from the day that you were created. Let's notice. Until iniquity was found in you. Verse 16. By the multitude of your merchandise, your trafficking, you, they have filled the midst of you with violence. And you have sinned. Therefore, I will cast you as a profane thing out of the mountain of God. No longer part of God's government. And I will destroy you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. Your heart, your mind was lifted up because of your beauty. In other words, he became filled with pride and self-will. And you have corrupted your wisdom by reason of your brightness. I will cast you to the ground. I will lay you before kings that they may behold you. You have defiled your sanctuaries by the multitude of your iniquities, by the iniquity of your traffic. Therefore will I bring forth a fire from the midst of you. It shall devour you. The Hebrew word means to consume, devour, to destroy. And I will bring you to ashes upon the earth in the sight of all them that behold you. And they who know you among the people, this is not talking about mankind. This is talking about the demons that have known him for a long, long time. And they shall be astonished at you, and you shall be a terror, in other words, to the demons, no more, and never shall you be any more. And I will quote what was written about Satan. Satan will be made to cease from existence when God's punishment is carried out. The fire that destroys him may well be speaking of terms of that which God has not yet revealed within the spirit world that can destroy a specific portion of a spirit creation that God sustains. God can cease to sustain what he sustains. And God sustains all that is in the physical realm and in the spirit realm. God can do as he wills. God has certainly left us with two possibilities so that we can know either one can be true. It is a matter of God's will and purpose of how it will be taken, how it will be gone about. God can create that which can be seen in a spirit world that appears as fire, which can consume what he has been sustaining. God can also make that which is composed of spirit become physical. Wouldn't that be irony? To do such a thing that Satan has so hated. And all that is physical can be easily destroyed and made ashes in a physical realm. Those who limit God are foolish indeed. Satan has always limited God and refused to magnify the unsearchable and unknowable power and majesty of his Creator. One of the truths of God that was revealed to you and me is there is an end to Satan's existence. His punishment is that of eternal death, never to have life again because of his rebellion, brethren. Some have believed that since angelic beings are composed of spirit, that they cannot cease to exist and are therefore eternal beings. Angelic beings can cease to exist, as we can see, because they are a created being. The only angelic being who has been formally judged by God, and I quote, through Scripture, is the one who was created in the beginning as Lucifer, but who now carries the names of Satan and the devil. We have been covering a lot about Satan and the demons that were created by God. And if we've looked in the past sermon how and what the demons did when Jesus Christ was upon this earth. We saw how they entered human beings and how God had it recorded in his book for you and me. God also tells us in his book how we are to handle these beings that we know exist. God tells you and me how to handle the demon world. And I will quote the post at this time because I was in the midst of these sermons when this post came out. As a matter of fact, I gave the first sermon in Florida. And Laura called me on the way back and I found out what the post was about when I was in the middle of addressing this. So I just injected that post into this sermon because it says it so well. And I'm going to read it. And Ron says, as we continue to draw nearer to the end of this age, the spirit world of Satan and the demons is increasingly becoming stirred up. This is now beginning to become more manifest around the environs of the church as those beings try to strike out at God's people in any way that they can. And since they have very little ability to attack us more directly, depending upon our own relationship with God, they tend to strike out at others, who in turn might themselves be able to distract, cause confusion, suffering, and hurt in our lives. And I think all of us experience that, and we need to know where it comes from. Although this has been happening at sporadic times and places over the past few years, seems to be on the increase at this time, and people need to be informed of steps they should take in such instances. These perverted beings are increasingly seeking to highly influence and even partially or fully possess someone who might be closer to us in a relationship or a work environment. First, for anyone who is seeking and applying themselves to live by God's way of life, there is nothing to fear in any way from these beings. Their influence is geared to harass and work at getting one's attention and mind preoccupied with distractions by causing one to begin to elevate these to levels of greater importance. than what they should be, thus sidetracking a person's focus and close relationship to God, the church, and the work that is before you and me. Certainly, there are basic things that one can do when such influences begin to encroach upon one's life. A person should seek to not become sidetracked spiritually by focusing too much upon them, but to instead become even more fully focused upon seeking God first through working to draw closer to God. These beings thrive on attention and recognition. The best thing is that they are ignored, as they have no importance in our lives. Too often people can begin to make such influence around them a big thing, and it begins to consume their lives. And they not only give them too much attention, but talk to others about these private matters. Certainly it's fine to contact a minister to seek guidance, but other than that, they are to be strictly ignored and given no attention at all. That is similar to why one should give no attention to blogs and other communications that are against you or others in God's church. A primary tool God has given us to sharpen our focus and build a stronger spiritual relationship with Him is through fasting. The reality is one that a perverted spirit world cannot stand God. They do not want to be too near where God is. And Merle and I used to have an office beside one of Satan's ministers. There's no other way to say it. And you would think the walls were coming down. It was flopping like a fish, and I don't know if they were jumping over tables and kicking the walls. And we would just put on a sermon and turn it as loud as we could get it. And about 10 minutes, you'd hear the door close. They were out the door and gone. And so we need to stay close to God and understand that these beings can't hurt us. They can kind of make you hurt yourself, I guess. But other than that, the stronger God is in our life, the more such beings will flee from our presence. They cannot stand to be around God. And this is why Ron says that he's mentioned in times past that even something as small and basic, here he's saying what I was talking about, is playing hymns aloud is highly agitating to them. And they do not like such an environment, especially a sermon. One of the more difficult situations to address is if someone is confronted when a perverted spirit influence begins working through someone who is close to them. And it is good and proper to pray and fast for one's own protection as well, seeking intervention from God to give help to such an individual who is under influence of a foul spirit and attack and influence. God seeks to protect those who look to Him. However, God may not intervene to always rebuke such demonic beings from having strong influence in other people's lives. This is generally because such individuals themselves are yielding to such influence in their life. Let's notice what Ron's saying. Due to personal sins, and especially due to hatred or jealousies they harbor toward God's church. God's people, and are you, in such a case, you will know quickly if God intervenes to rebuke, and if He does not, you'll know it quickly. Then if not, you yourself will have decisions and choices that you must make. You may be confronted with having to decide if such influence and the individual being influenced has begun to move your focus away from God and His church, and whether you must separate yourself farther from such influence and our individuals, talking about relationships. The reality is, if God does not speedily intervene in such matters, then you must decide if you will flee by whatever means necessary. And you cannot save what God has not chosen to save at this time. That's not within your power. Obviously, the choice of such a matter is for you to make when it comes down to what is said and done. Let's turn over to James chapter 4. James chapter 4, and let's look at verse 1. God tells you and me how to live. And we know that there is always the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. And that these are strong pulls in this physical body. But we in God's church have to resist these pulls. And we are to bring every thought into subjection, as God says. And James addresses some of these things and tells us how we are to resist the demon world. We've looked at this demon world through the sermons that have been given, and we need to understand that they are here and they are real. Not as this world pictures the demon world. This world has a day called Halloween, which pictures the demon world as something to take lightly, that it is just fun and games, something to have fun with. And they celebrate the demons once a year. They dress up as these demons, and they celebrate the demon world. And they have a night of what they call trick-or-treat. James 4 and verse 1 tells us, by asking a few questions, James asks, "Where do wars and fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members?" Let's notice, "You lust and do not have. Lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and the pride of life," which we've addressed in earlier sermons. And James is addressing the problems, and it is the wrong way of life. The mind is not on God's way of life. That's what he's saying. And he says, "You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight in war, yet you do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive." So here James is telling us what is taking place in the mind. And let's notice what James says. "Because you ask amiss, that you may spend it on your pleasures." Tells us where the mind is. It's not on God. And James calls it what it is. We understand what spiritual adultery is. And he says, "Adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself," let's notice, "an enemy of God." That's what takes place. "Or do you think that the Scripture says in vain, the Spirit who dwells in us yearns jealously? But he gives more grace. Therefore he says, God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble." In verse 7, let's notice what God tells you and me to do. God tells us through James that we are to submit to God and live the way of life that God tells you and me to live. And do not commit spiritual adultery. To stay close to God and always submit to God. God says, therefore submit to God. Let's notice, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. He cannot stand to be around God. God says to draw near to him, and he will draw near to you. And let's notice, cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, your minds, you double-minded. So God is telling us to clean up our lives and live the way that God says to live. The temple is being measured, brethren. And this should bring you to your knees to understand where you are in time. God is cleaning the church up. That's what's taking place. Verse 10. God says to humble ourselves in the sight of the Eternal, and He will lift us up. And we looked at Korah and how he spoke to Moses and Aaron and how he accused them and the evil that they did by speaking against God. That's what he accused them. And that those that God has set in authority. God tells us here what we are to do, brethren. Do not speak evil, verse 11, of one another. He who speaks evil of a brother and judges his brother speaks evil of the law. And let's notice, judges the law. That's what takes place when we do these things. If you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge. That's what you become. There is one lawgiver who is able to save and destroy. Who are you to judge another? Verse 14. We can see we have little time upon this earth, and we should use it in obedience to our God. Life is short. And it says, what is your life? He tells us that it is even a vapor that appears for a little while and just vanishes away. It's like a puff of smoke, and it's gone in the space of time. And he says, instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we should live and do this or that. But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. We know this human mind, this carnal mind. And we know that it's hostile against God. And it's our constant battle to fight this mind. Verse 17, therefore to him who knows to do good and does not do it, let's notice, if we know these things and we don't do them, it is sin. It's a pretty stout statement. Let's turn over to Matthew 16. And let's look at an account that took place. Matthew 16, let's look at verse 22. And it's an account where Peter took Jesus Christ aside and told him. He told Jesus Christ this. It was very presumptuous of Peter to do such a thing. But Peter did it. And let's notice what took place. And Peter told Jesus Christ not to be saying these things. Peter actually rebuked Jesus Christ. And let's see how Jesus reacted and what he said to Peter. Matthew 16 and verse 22. And he said, far be it from you, Lord, this shall not happen to you. But he turned aside and said to Peter, Jesus told Peter. Let's notice. Jesus recognized it, where it was coming from. And he said, get behind me, Satan. You are an offense to me. Let's notice. For you are not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men. I think Jesus at this time had told Peter enough about God's plan that Peter knew what the plan was. And that's why Jesus did this. And he recognized where the influences were coming from. And that's why he said, get behind me, Satan. Because it was a demonic influence that had taken place. Go to Romans 13. Romans 13. And we'll look at verse 1. And it's the subject matter is about submission to the authorities that are in place. So this is the subject matter. Romans 13 and verse 1. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities. Let's notice, for there is no authority except from God. That is who we are to obey, the great God of this universe and His Son. That's where it comes from. In the church of God. And let's notice. And those that exist. In other words, those that God has chosen to be the governing authorities upon this earth. Those that have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever, let's notice, resists the authorities, resists what God has appointed. And those who resist, let's notice, will incur judgment. Those who rebel, brethren, and we've looked at what God had written about those that rebel today. And we've looked at God, how God handled those in the past that rebelled. And we've looked at how in the day of judgment, what many will face. There is a day of judgment in the future. A judgment for eternity. Never to have life again. Death for all eternity. That's God's final judgment when it's all said and done. God says that rulers are not a terror to good conduct. In other words, if you're living God's way, all of this is moot anyway. It's not an issue. But if you're not, but to bad, let's notice. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? We saw it in Korah. no fear of who God had placed in authority. Here's what God says that you and me are to do. We are to do what is good. Then none of this is an issue. And you will receive God's approval. And you will also have the approval of God's servant when you do these things. For he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid. You know why? There's a day of judgment in the future. For he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. We saw Moses do this. Therefore, one must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. Because we know when we're not doing things the way we should do. We know it. Some things are just the plan of God, brethren, just like Jesus told Peter. That's what he was telling him, in essence. And he was being influenced by a demonic world. But there are some things that are just the plan of God. And that's the way it's meant to be. And we are not to put ourselves into position of going against God's plan. Especially rebuking one another in authority that God has placed one in. We saw what Peter did, and Jesus saw that it was influences from Satan. And he rebuked Peter. Jesus Christ himself tells us, and he says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. It's what Jesus says. No one comes to the Father except through him. And no one comes to the Father except through me. And you can find that in John 14 if you want to note it. The true leaders of the church of God are called by God, brethren. False teachers, on the other hand, God says that they are wolves in sheep's clothing. And they are amongst those that left us. That's what they are. They are in wolf's clothing, seeking to deceive you. Korah's rebellion is very similar to that of Lucifer. Not content to serve God in the way that God ordained him. Lucifer wanted to ascend above the heavens and take over the throne of God. Korah's rebellion against Moses is a sign, a lesson for you and me today. We are to serve the Eternal with all our heart and all our minds. And we are to be content with the gift, because that's what it is, brethren, of what you know. It's a gift from God to know what you know and for the opportunities that you have for the future. The opportunity that God has given you to just be able to sit here today amongst God's people. And I hope you understand what you've been given, brother. I hope you grasp it. We are to shun those who struggle for power. And we are to get away from their tents just as fast as we can, because they are heading for a day of judgment in the future, if repentance is not, if things are not repented of. And I have feared that some have gone too far. But judgment is coming. There is a day that is coming in the future. And that is the real lesson of Korah for you and me today, is to not rebel. And with that will end the sermon today.